Welcome to Holden Village. Today is Friday, August 25th, 1995. In the fireside room this morning, our speaker is Dion Stuthman, and he will be speaking on biotechnology, is it playing God? Let's listen in on Dion Stuthman.
My name is Dion Stuthman. I'm from the University of Minnesota, Department of Agronomy and Plant Genetics, and the title of the session today is Biotechnology, is it playing God? Or some version thereof, anyway. What I want to do today is to, in one sense, extend the discussion of last night on the sustainability of agriculture. And in another sense, complete the loop back to the first session that I had, which was on emphasizing the why instead of the how of creation, and in the process hopefully also connecting the other session about on hunger as well. Because there are a few faces that are new, as well as I welcome the ones who've been here before, just by way of background, my specialty at the university, and what I have to do occasionally to get paid is to work on the genetics of oats, and it's particularly pleasing to me to see oatmeal in some form and for breakfast every morning. I've left some information for the director, one of which I know reasonably well, about some additional possibilities of incorporating oats into the menu and diet of the operation. No expectations on my part in terms of whether it will be incorporated or not. Just provide the information, see what happens. I had particular involvement in this topic. In some sense, I'm part of a research group that goes all the way from cloning genes, on the one hand, to clear over to the other end, which is where I am in the team, on actual application and modification of plants to make them more useful, in this case, oats, in the ultimate food chain situation. But specifically with regard to this topic, about a year, oh no, 2 years ago, I spent a considerable amount of time preparing a response to the FDA with regard to the whole issue of labeling relative to biotechnically produced or modified plants. So that's probably the best credential I can offer you. Unfortunately, in my haste to make last-minute preparations to attend, participate in the village this week, I neglected to bring a copy or copies of that publication along. So I'll try to send one out to the library once I return. Because this is and I like the style of the village in terms of the isolation, but it isn't compatible in one sense with my normal method of operation, which is that I would have called my secretary on Monday morning as soon as I realized that, and by Tuesday night it would have been here in one fashion or another, if not before. In fact, as I was telling people that I was going to be out here for a week, lots of people who know me well said, "You'll never make it because you won't be able to call your secretary for at least a week." I'm making it. Yeah, that's right. I helped prepare psychologically for it, though. Okay, given all of that, and as a result, also, I'm a late and more recently I described it as an uncertain addition to the teaching staff, and as a result, I didn't get the communication to the bookstore, et cetera, with regard to books that might be particularly appropriate. What I have done, just this morning, I went through the library and found three books that address the topic in various sorts of ways. The first one, I think, is just absolutely excellent, and I will acquire this book when I get back home. It's Taking Sides, Clashing Views on Controversial Bioethical Issues by Carol Levine. And the reason that I think it's really excellent is that it not only talks about things that I'm going to talk about this morning, but there's a part on choices in reproduction, decisions about death, the doctor-patient relationship, human and animal experimentation, and I'll talk about a little of that, public policy and bioethics. And on each of these, there are there are 21 specific issues that are identified, and in each case, what they do is to get to have a written debate, and there's a pro and a con on each of these items, and I'm certain that there's at least one of these issues that would be of particular interest to each one of you. I'm just going to presume that, assert that, and in the process, perhaps compel you to at least take a look at the book anyway. It's in the library, and it will be back in the library in a few minutes after this session is over. Great book. Second one is kind of the kind of book that it's entitled The Next 100 Years, Shaping the Fate of Our Living Earth by Jonathan Weiner, who also wrote Planet Earth. You may be familiar with that. This book I would describe in the following fashion. Much of what's in here, and I haven't read it all, but from the description and so forth, is kind of a nice connection between what I talked about last night and what we're talking about in one sense today, at least part of it anyway. Let me just read one little paragraph to you. Today, many Earth scientists feel the study of the planet is on the verge of a second revolution. The first was characterized by the discovery of turbulence. We probably all in one sense recognize that, and we're probably still being buffeted about by that turbulence. This revolution is marked by the discovery of connections. That's the second one. And that really relates back to the points that I was making in the first session, the first night, in terms of ultimately what we ought to be, not just be environmentalists, not just be theologians, whatever, what we need to be in terms of creation is ecologists. And the ultimate, as far as ecology is concerned, and the reason why it's important is that we not only identify the parts, in the case of the biosphere, but we also try to understand the interconnection among the parts so that we ultimately get some notion of the grand scheme of things, and then would be at least somewhat better equipped to make some judgments in terms of management or whatever, once we understand how it is that things are supposed to work, either in the theoretical or the ideal. So that's kind of what, and then today we're going to talk about some possibilities, for instance, relative to the future. In some cases, possibilities of fixing things that we've messed up, and in some other cases, creating some things that haven't been available heretofore. Now, some of you might want to pursue in some greater depth the outer limits of life a molecular biologist looks at life and the implications of genetic research by John Medina. Lots of you might not be attracted to this. It's maybe a bit difficult and rather specialized, but I at the moment I'm not going to say anything more about it than that. Okay, what I sort of want to do is to split this topic up into four situations. The first is the possibilities, and I'm not sure I've identified all. If any of you have something else that you want to add to this list as we go through it, please do so. But the possibilities that we might enjoy, might benefit from, in a net sort of way, from biotechnology. And that, at least to a certain extent, ties back to the notion of the picture that I created in the second session on hunger and the third session on sustainable agriculture. And there are people who now take the position that, you know, we've got this biotechnology, we've got these new technologies, and somehow or other they'll save us, so we can kind of still be continuing our numbness. On the other hand, there's also some people who are just, you know, thinking in terms really about some of the possibilities that, not in the way of fixing or correcting, but just having some things, some opportunities that we haven't had so far. Then I'm going to, once we do a little bit of that, then I'm going to I have a list here of what biotechnology is. I could have started out with the notion of asking you, and I should probably, I will in one sense, ask you what your impressions of biotechnology are. And the polls that have been done in some of these areas, and by the way, this is an area in which if you will, in one sense, the big boys are particularly interested in finding out about public perception, because they've already gotten a clue that there's going to be, at best, perhaps marginal acceptance of, and therefore they need to find out first what the perception is, and then that would perhaps guide some kind of an educational program that might raise the level of understanding, and of course their hope is in the process to raise the level of acceptance of the products coming from biotechnology. Now, it isn't automatic that you go from one to two to three, but they hope that sometimes that connection will be made anyway, because, well, ultimately, there's a lot of money involved in all this. If there isn't protests and so forth and so on, either personal, private, or public, and in some cases almost ugly, with regard to products coming from. Then I want to talk a little bit about the specific thing about the labeling, the right to know, and I want to do it in the context of, and keep coming back to, previous points that I was trying to make, and that's why the first one is there, even though in some sense that might not look whatever. I think it's important in the notion of caring for creation and so forth that we understand what it is that this technology is providing to us, and we understand in a rather fundamental or basic sort of way, so that we don't fall victim to losing touch with our roots, with the creation. And I was talking to John Schramm this morning, because I'm still trying, this is my first visit to a whole village, and I'm still trying to get to fully appreciate, and I'm sure I won't for some time, because it'll require reflection as well, but I'm trying to appreciate the spirit and the philosophy of Holden Village. And one of the things that I sense is that there's an appropriate reluctance with regard to various parts of various things that, quote unquote, technology has to offer, in the sense of making sure that people still are able to connect with the basics, with the fundamentals, with things as they started, if you will. And I appreciate that. In fact, many times we in agriculture bemoan the fact that although in one of those polls that I read, they said that 90% of the people think they know where their food comes from. Emphasis on my part on think, because depending upon the level of specificity that you're thinking about, and if I wanted to be a bit harsh, I would say 90% don't have a clue. But they think they do, so then the next thing then is to try to see, and that's why the polls are being taken in some cases, is to try to see where people's understanding is, whether or not it's either whether or not it is understanding, whether it is misunderstanding, or whether it is a gap in the sense, because in each case that would help decide what the nature of the educational program might be to try to increase that level of understanding. And by the way, we're now going to, in this situation, ultimately we get down into, well, and the last thing that I want to do is this notion of trust us. we'll do good things. Just trust us. But when we're now into very, very much opinion, public policy, emotional kinds of things, I have a little saying that says, when you're dealing generally with politics, okay, and reality and perception are on a collision course, put all of your money on perception, because reality doesn't make any difference. Perception will win every time, and it will be a complete victory. Now there are things that you can do to modify the perception to bring it closer to the reality, but the perception is still going to
Whose perception is that?
Everybody's perception. That's it's the collective presumed understanding, and when I say presumed understanding, that borders on misconception, but perceptions can be in touch with reality too. I say when perception is on a collision course with reality, put your money on perception, especially if you're in the political operations. And then I think the whole, in some sense, the whole notion, is it playing God, that there's has to do with the considerations relative to proper application. And some of this has more to do with practical things in one sense, some of these more specifically addressing, is it playing God? And I would say that actually, the is it playing God has two dimensions to it. On the one hand, it's the sort of the active thing. We're doing something that people, in some cases, basically, there are actions that people want to reserve for God. And they're now being done, or the possibility of being done by humans. One of them, for instance, is to create life from non-living material. On the other hand, if we talk about, in some cases, correcting some medical deficiencies, and we argue about whether or not that's appropriate, Another aspect of creating God, playing God, might be the notion that preventing by rejecting a particular situation, preventing somebody's access to a possible correction of a deficiency, might also be playing God. And so I think the idea of playing God can be, there's at least two sides to that kind of situation, not just the one that we might think about in terms of are humans now doing things that we think should be reserved for God in the sense of actions, but it also can be in the sense of preventing activities as well. Okay. While I'm reading my notes, any comments, rebuttals? I love rebuttals. So if you got some, let's get them up there. Go ahead.
I see one topic under the theme visit playing God that sort of fits in there, but isn't specifically listed, and that's okay. The idea of prenatal diagnostics, selecting against certain traits in an unborn child.
Well, it's not in here directly, but it is in a sense here. Because in fact, in some cases, and phentocantinuria is the best example that I can. By the way, I'm not a medic, so I don't want to even run the risk of being accused of practicing medicine. But phentocantinuria, it's now not a problem because we do a test very early, modify the diet at this point. And then we don't observe the symptoms.
I'm thinking more in terms of, do we have now an incurable disease that we can recognize genetically before birth? Mm-hmm. Do we abort that fetus because that fetus is going to...
That's the contemporary situation. But let me just jump ahead a little bit. Maybe we don't abort the fetus, but we change the gene. We knock out the gene, or we replace that gene with a different gene, so that the condition isn't allowed to develop. That's, if we're going to talk about the future, that's where the attention should be. And in fact, I could, in terms of the abortion considerations having to do with that, those kinds of situations. I could visualize if we were to move and have develop this whole thing, that we could eliminate the need for abortion, for the most part, when that's what we're talking about. Now, there are other reasons for abortion, but at least that particular reason could basically be eliminated, because at least the potentials and the imaginations in some cases are such that. That's what we're talking about, the gene therapy, if you will.
Mm-hmm. I don't know if you're going to hit that, but how far in the future are we looking for some of these things?
Well, let's see. You look like you're quite a bit younger than me. You're more likely to realize that than I might be, although if you listen to Buzz Kahn, and if I program my life out, and I think, by the way, he's got a good point, program my life out in 5-year segments, I might see it too. Now that's not a very good answer in one sense, and the reason is that it's very risky to predict in terms of numbers of years what that might be. And furthermore, it's particularly risky for me because I have less information than other people have, even with regard to where they are, what's needed to get to that point and so forth. But, and of course, the other thing in all of this has to do with, as we start talking about these kinds of things, and appropriately, those kinds of considerations come up, some of these things might be slowed down while we argue and debate whether or not it's appropriate to do them. May or may not, but I can give you but the best example of that is the organ transplant. Do you know when the first animal to human organ transplant was done?
Well,
Animal to human.
Animal to human. 31 years ago. We've only done about four or five because there's lots of feelings and considerations and so forth that there's lots of potential for inappropriate kinds of things or inappropriate kinds of procedures or so forth and so on. And so in fact, I think that, and not complaining or necessarily being critical, I'm just using it as an illustration of the fact that those considerations have slowed down. I'm convinced that if we had the first organ transplant 30 years ago, and if there was less consideration as to whether that's appropriate or not, we would have made a lot more progress.
What was the operation and where was it done?
It was a kidney or perhaps a heart. It was done in the United States, I think in 1964. One that you might remember, there was the baby Faye who got the heart of the baboon. And that was just a couple of years ago. And again, I don't want to say because we were talking this morning about, you know, the ultimate thing in this is proper application, and so then the next question is what is proper, and I haven't decided for myself, so I'm clearly not going to try and tell you. Yeah, go ahead.
Well, just to address your question, I read a little bit about one instance where they did a procedure that was sick that's been successful so far. It was, I can't remember the details, but several children that had a disease that had to do with injecting healthy cells or something, and it did at least relieve the symptoms for a period of time, and it had to be done every couple of months or so, but it is working.
The thing right now, the context right now would be the fact that there are not enough organ donors. By the way, you can probably get at least some of that kind of information in this book. There's Arthur Kaplan, who now is at the University of Pennsylvania, was at University of Minnesota, biomedical ethicist, makes the case for animal to human organ transplants, and it has some of the details in there. You can make the, right now the context is that it's done on an interim basis. There aren't enough human organs, so for a short time intervening, we will use an animal organ, and as soon as we can, a human organ, appropriate human organ is available, we will redo the surgery, replace that animal organ with the human organ. And so right now the context is not permanent replacement, but interim because of necessity of lack of availability. It slightly modifies, it seems to me, the debate with regard to whether it's appropriate and ethical or not. But actually, it doesn't dismiss the debate, or it doesn't dismiss the issue as being moot, in my opinion. The question still is there, anyway, as to whether it's appropriate or not. Okay, anything else? We'll share our feelings and so forth. Okay, let me just go through these kind of quickly. And then, you know, if things could pop up, that's fine. What is it? Most people, I think, if they're at all in touch with the specifics of biotechnology, or if they have particular opinions, feelings, whatever, are probably, most of them are aimed at the notion of gene transfer, genetic engineering, that sort of thing. It could actually, this could be gene transfer, or as I've suggested just before, it could be gene elimination. Sometimes you can just knock out the offending gene, and that would prevent the condition from developing. Now, see, I'm a conventional plant breeder, which means that I've been making crosses, or somebody's been making crosses for me for 30 plus years. And so the notion, in one sense, that genetic engineering, well, I don't know if it's irritating is the right word, but I would suggest that on the part of some people who think it's brand new, that they're horribly naive. Now, they would think they're very sophisticated, but in any event, the point I want to make here is that in another one of these surveys, people were asked, as a part of all of this, just what about the traditional inter-animal hybrid crosses? Now, do you all know that a mule is the cross between a horse and a donkey? Okay. That's obviously an inter-animal cross. In this poll, 50% of the people, and this was let's just assume this was some kind of a legitimate cross-section of people, you or whoever else, 50% of the people said a mule is immoral.
Is immoral?
Immoral. They said any inter-animal cross is immoral. You don't believe that, huh?
Yeah, I do.
Okay. I had a little trouble because, I, in my profession, we could be called the chief sinners of whatever, it sounds like, in one sense. What that did was to really sensitize me to the feeling that some people have about this notion of playing God, and that the idea itself, regardless of the product, regardless of the implications and so forth, is just totally unacceptable to me. If a mule is immoral, I mean, in the sense of genetic engineering, there's no point in even talking about it. Let's put it this way. There's a point to an educational program that's got to get us to the point of trying to somehow come to terms with the notion that 50% of people think a mule is immoral. Long before we ever start talking about genetic engineering in its contemporary...
I used to know the same people thought organ transplants was immoral because if God wanted that person to die, you're putting a new heart in them.
Yeah, well, that's why I wanted early on to point out to you that there's at least two sides to the notion of playing God, and in the one case, about the actions that we might reserve for God, and on the other hand, whether or not we deny somebody access. If you deny somebody access to the correction for their problem and they die, is that murder? Go ahead.
My awareness too is that humans are most concerned about the species that are like them. So we are most concerned about issues that deal with humans or animals. And beyond animals, invertebrates and everything else, humans, people don't seem to have, they don't care. Like, for example, hybridizing two different species of plant. Now, is anybody going to say that's immoral? I don't think so.
Less so, for sure.
Yeah. And I think that's part of human nature. Certainly what I observe.
Like
conservation or care for species, Alaska oil spill, what were they concerned about? Mammals and birds, not the lower forms for which the whole food chain is based.
So. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I didn't pay her to say that either. but she nicely expressed some other of my irritations having to do with the fact that people, on the one hand, want to talk about life and want to put life and living things into very special category and so forth, but they stop when they get done with animals, and even though plants are alive, they don't count. Or if there's competition or conflict between plants and animals, they always let the animals win. Even though the animals won't last long if they don't have plants to eat. But that's another issue that unless you get to know some more of the details and the fundamentals of how the components of creation interact with each other, you kind of miss part of the picture. Everybody has...
Look at where money's spent.
Pardon?
Well, maybe now look at where money is spent, what a liver transplant can do.
Yeah, well, that's sort of an operational ethical consideration in one sense. That is, after you decide that it's appropriate to do it in a generic sense, then how do you do it in a specific sense? I will have trouble getting through this in a generic sense, but I share the I don't know if it's cynicism on your part or not, but it is on my part with regard to that little incident. I don't have anything against Mickey Mantle, but the people around him. Anyway, the labeling, the right to know thing, really, again, as an educator, you know, if you're going to make good decisions, you make good decisions after you've been informed about the options, the considerations, and so forth and so on. And there's a number of considerations in this thing. I draw the line between safety and decision-making because that's one that comes immediately to the forefront. But there's others. But in a general sort of way, the decision-making has to do with, if we could always assure that whatever the application was, that it was going to be proper, we'd more likely decide yes. But why we don't decide yes, or we're reluctant to decide yes, is because we always know about the fact that this person and that person isn't going to behave like we think they should after we've said they can go ahead. And therefore, we don't say they can go ahead because that, if we stop the process in the beginning, that is a sure way to control their behavior. If we let the process start, then we have more difficulty in terms of trying to make sure that the process is being done in a manner that we would approve of. Not just with regard to biotechnology, we use that strategy in everything, okay? And then again, this is the thing that when we made the arguments, and there was about five of us who made this presentation ultimately as a response to some questions on behalf of our organization to the FDA, I was the one who, in this particular group of people, who was most emphatic about this notion about not trusting us and so forth. On the other hand, the labeling, in one sense, has to be done. It has to be done in a certain kind of a situation. If people understand what the labeling says, and if they understand what the labeling is intended to tell them, that's one thing. On the other hand, if, for example, by the very process of labeling that something is so-and-so, that automatically conjures up in people's minds that it's not safe, or that it's automatically, they should question it, whereas if they didn't have the label on it, they wouldn't question it, then there's some problems with that, and sometimes the labeling actually will have the unintended effect because people will, how much do you pay attention to, even though I'm not sure any of you buy a package of cigarettes anymore, those people who buy a package of cigarettes, do people see the warning on the label, on the thing? Do you imagine, do they?
They know it's there.
Yeah, they know it's there, but do they see it?
They don't.
Do they read it?
They don't want to see it, so they're happy.
But the same thing may be true in some cases for labeling relative to these kinds of things and nutrition kinds of things. It's to the point that it's routine and monotonous and so forth and so on. So in fact, for a lot of people, it may again not have the intended consequence. On the other hand,
And is it correct too? That's the other thing. Is the labeling correct, and is it hitting its intended?
Yeah. Well, I like some of the lines that I've heard here. Buzz Kahn the other day said, "When there's two Jews present, there will be three opinions." Well, when you're dealing with scientists, because we always, actually academics, we always say, it depends. I can tell you that when you've got two academics, you could have up to 10 or 12 opinions, not just three. Depending upon the situation, it depends. They all could have some validity in certain circumstances. So, it's like beauty. Somewhere, ultimately, it's in the eyes of the beholder. Okay, now, the safety considerations, access considerations, this for me is very important. We're talking about big money, and in some cases, for example, if we're talking about trying to fix some of these things, and what we do is to have a differential access between have and have-nots, what we may just do is to fix one problem, but basically create another one, which might be even less manageable.
Can you give an example?
Pardon?
Can you give an example?
Examples of several things. I mean, you take any kind of process that involves a new technology, or new practices anyway. Let's talk about, for example, animal confinement systems, which they allow for much higher, in some sense, efficiency production of meat and so forth and so on. Probably the most classic example now is the difficulties in waste management, and on not too long ago, one of the hog operations, the lagoon broke, and what some people will do, for instance, is to work on a bacteria or something that could be introduced into that lagoon, and it could be used to digest the waste, and therefore it would be less damaging. And that might work. Another possibility in more traditional kinds of things is that occasionally we might import, for instance, a certain insect or so, or let's say we would import a predator. I don't care. I just use that term generically. And after a while, the predator becomes more than a predator. The predator becomes a pest. So what you did was to perhaps get rid of the first pest, and you now have another one, and this one may be harder to deal with than what the first one was. That's the kind of thing we're talking about. Another thing in all this is having to do with whether or not it addresses a real need. And that gets to acceptance of the product. I mean, I am absolutely convinced that the negative reaction to BST, even though it's been made in the name of food safety, has almost no real basis in terms of safety. What it is to do is that, why do we want to have a technology that produces more of what we already have too much of? Terrible, terrible tactical decision. Absolutely illogical. On the other hand, and you may say the same thing about flavor-saver tomato, but I'll make a case. I can argue both sides of that, and pressed I will. Just in a general sort of way, to think about unwanted consequences, and sometimes if we were to be tighter about proper or prescribed confined applications, we might have less of these. And then, in a general sort of way, the whole notion about the ethical considerations. Let me go back here just for a moment with regard to the transfer and the organ transplant. That can fully be subdivided, both of these, into two humans and then from the same species or from different species. And you can, both of these are here. When, if we get to the point that we decide that it's appropriate to take genes from another species and incorporate them into the genome of humans to deal with some difficulty, then we will come full circle back to the arguments that I made the other night about the fact that you could divide the species into three categories: useful, nearly extinct or endangered, and then the one that I like, in one sense, the obnoxious, but competitive. Because obnoxious is in one context, in one time frame, but it's just possible that that mosquito has a gene that at least some humans could benefit from. And so we ought to be careful before we swat that fly. Noah didn't do it, you know. We ought to be careful so that we're not cutting off our nose to spite our face. Although when they're obnoxious and numerous, you could get rid of a couple, two or three. And you wouldn't run the risk necessarily of not having one available, to be sure. Okay. The other thing, particularly in the case of gene transfer, and that's in one sense the business I'm in, that we would talk about to plants and animals, not just to humans. And then again, it can be within the same species, and that's just an extension of a classical hybridization, or between species. And actually, it could be between plants and animals. You could do the whole thing between plants and animals, between animals and human, and so forth. By the way, we talk about, we have a concept in genome analysis now. By genome analysis, I mean the analysis of the entire chromosomal material that's involved in an organism. It's called conservation. By conservation, what we mean is the identicalness of the DNA in one organism versus another. And I don't like to carry around specific details with regard to actual numbers, because in fact, in most cases, the rest of them are not actual numbers anyway. But let me just throw out the notion that perhaps in the case of the mice, that maybe as much as 50% of the DNA in mice is identical to that in humans. And in fact, you can take, as you do a genome analysis of the mice, we now have computer programs and so forth that line up the DNA, the map for mice, and you line up pieces of it for the mouse, and you see where they fit together. And that should not be surprising ultimately, because there are a number of metabolic processes in all living things that have, depend upon the level of specificity that you go to, that have, they're all sort of similar. For those of you who are biologists, the Krebs cycle, the thing operates in lots of human beings, and probably does so because it gets the same set of instructions regardless of the species that it happens to operate in. It wouldn't make a lot of sense, in one sense, to have different sets of instructions, because that would be actually wasteful. Once you get a pattern and it works, why not use it over and over again? There's some dangers associated with that. I think one of the things, this is a little bit facetious, and I tell people around me that basically you have to take me only serious about 50% of the time, and your challenge is to figure out which is the 50%. So
yeah.
Which 50%? In this case, we've talked about the notion of thought about the notion of evolution and so forth, and the fact that we have some considerable similarities to the ape and so forth. And sometimes I think that people don't want to pursue that. just in case they learn something that they aren't particularly happy about, to that sort of situation.
That's the same 50% as with the donkey and the... That's the same 50% that don't want to deal with
I suspect that there's a considerable overlap, but I don't know. On the other hand, you know, every once in a while, if I want to be really cruel, I could see somebody and I could say, pretty good evidence. Distinction between humans and at least, I mean, that human, apes, tough to separate. And maybe in some cases, even behavior might even be more or less distinctive. Okay. The notion of the cell culture. One of the things here, and there's some, that ultimately, in some sense, can relate back over to this thing right here. Actually, can do it right there, too. And it can relate here. Cell culture is the notion, is not the notion, it's the process, and we're getting better and better at it all the time. Actually, it's been available in one sense for 40, 50 years. Again, those of you who are know something about that, the first actual success in taking, in this case, a small group of cells, still less than, the clump was still small enough that you couldn't see it with your eye, and ultimately with a series of media and so forth, developing a new carrot plant. So he took a few cells of the carrot and put it in the right kind of test tube. Not test tube, doesn't make any difference, but the right kind of media in the test tube, and ultimately produced the carrot in just those couple cells. That had a couple of implications. One of them, of course, is that every cell has one of the information that's needed to produce the organism. So, for example, just to give you a little something to think about when you're bored, the fact that the cells in your finger have all of the DNA information that the cells in your hair, in your eye, and so forth, they all have the same amount of DNA information. But it's obvious that not all cells use all the information. That's what we call the process of differentiation. And the whole notion of how some cells use some information, other cells use other information, and so forth, is very fascinating. It's also, in some sense, yet still quite mysterious. Although, as we do some of these things, as we learn aspects of that sort of thing, it's going to help us correct some of those deficiencies. It could help us create some new forms of the same situation. And eventually, if we figure it's appropriate, it could help us create life from non-living material. But specifically with regard to the cell culture, we now can take a couple cells of a plant, probably a plant that already has some potential to act as a sponge for a particular toxic element, let's say lead. There are now plants that we have increased the capacity of those plants to absorb lead if they're going wherever the lead. So you can take, bless you, you can take plants, put them on an area, land area, that's been contaminated with lead, and let the plants, by growing, suck up the lead. Now you still have the lead, and you have to deal with it, but it's at least in a little bit more of a manageable form than what it was when it was pervasively contaminating the soil. One of the ways to develop those kinds of plants, if I think, at least it makes sense to me, it would be a strategy that I would invoke if I were going. And by the way, those kinds of plants, that's one of the new exciting possibilities in terms of plant research these days, as far as creating sort of new forms of plants, is to think, to do the sponging. Yeah.
Could there be any application there for expunging lead poisoning from the body?
Well, yeah, perhaps. Not plants, but probably microorganisms might be a possibility, yes. But the point, anyway, is that we get down to a single cell or two. We put that single cell or two into a medium that has a fair amount of that toxicity, that toxic element. And at least as a starting point, the cells that survive will be able to function in a climate in which that toxicity exists. And you have to go a little bit further yet to be the sponge, but at least now you've got plants that will survive this toxicity, which previously we didn't have that. And that's at least the first step. So in fact, that's something that could be having to do with at least fixing the messes anyway. Another example of the kind of question you ask is that, you know, we have made messes in some cases with regard to contaminating things. And we could also, for example, in some cases, we're now in the process of creating microorganisms, which will probably be able to deal with oil slicks.
We have the greatest laboratory right here for applying that. The tailings of getting vegetation to grow and suck up the arsenic and so on and so forth.
Yeah, good point.
You need to go to the science and technology meeting tonight if everybody gets here. Are you part of that?
I've been invited and I'll probably come for a while for sure. Unfortunately, I'm going to be leaving tomorrow at noon, but I'd like to be a part of that sort of thing, and that's exactly right. You actually have a couple of things that you can think about. One of them is that, how many of you know about the Burchard Gardens in the, I think I went in, okay.
Burchard.
I didn't pronounce it right, sorry about that. Do you know what that was?
That was a cement quarry, lime. It was a lime quarry for lime to make cement.
So you can do something about these things. Some of it first requires some imagination, vision, that sort of thing, and then you have to, you know, match up some of the physical requirements and logistics with the dream and that sort of thing. But
that's the life of the entrepreneur.
Yeah, right. It's a beautiful history too. I was there last November. Had to look at most of the blooms and so forth through pictures and whatever, but
it's still
a nice. Nice exhibit of what can be done, and hopefully will give people imagination and vision that there might be other locations. I don't know that it's working, but somebody had this dream anyway of taking some of the mine pits, filling them with water, and using them to raise fish in Minnesota.
The open pit.
What?
The Duluth open pit.
Yeah. I don't know how the fish are doing, but.
I think they had some problems with that.
I think probably that's the case. But the point is that if you get to a certain situation, you know, and it just requires some operational tweaking to make it go, then you know, most of the battle is won. You get to a certain point. And anyway, the point simply is that there are some potentials and some possibilities in some cases for doing something creative and ultimately very attractive and desirable with some of these situations when we kind of put our creative juices in motion. Let me see what it's there. There's anything else, any other particular
point? I think that the question comes to mind, what if that plant that sucks up lead is competitive with a plant that does something else? I mean, and that gets to the, there are possibilities, good, creative, wonderful, rejuvenating possibilities, life-giving, and then there are exact proper applications where unwanted consequences can come out. And the skeptic in me says, trust us, we know this plant will help suck up this lead and all, and there's a possible medical application of people children that have lead poisoning, this pill that will suck up the lead in their body and they can poop it out or, you know, whatever. And just trust us, we know. And the next thing you know, these children have leukemia that's the skeptic part of me, especially when there is money involved or there is power involved.
and...
No, that's the same thing.
That's the plain God.
Yeah.
That's the thing about this whole process that bothers me is a lot of this is going to happen because money is the driver. And if there's the perceived financial gain, somewhere somebody's going to do it without necessarily the premonitory thought that needs to go in about the safety and proper application, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah. That's why, you know, as much as I don't necessarily like to think about some of the rules and regulations that have been proposed, you know, it ultimately comes down to a matter of this, in the sense that if we could trust each other's motives, then the people on the one hand wouldn't do things unless there was really good reasons for doing them, and then you wouldn't get the opposite reaction on the other hand, is that we're going to put every obstacle possible in the face of, and if you can jump all those hoops, then okay, we'll let you go ahead.
And something that may be beneficial may never get to market or may never get to fruition.
Exactly. And that's again another illustration of the flip side of, you know, everybody's playing God, or there's a potential for everybody, both sides to play God.